Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. Before we get into our superlatives for the 2024 PGA Tour season, before we kick off what to watch for with the fall slate and the Solheim Cup, some news of the week. Representatives from the PGA Tour and a Saudi public investment fund met this week in New York City on the eve of 9/11 to continue in-person talks as it relates to a deal that would reunify the game and pump money into PGA Tour enterprises. Rex, what is your read on this situation? Does this now mean a deal is imminent? Is this simply an uptick in activity and a continuation of what's been going on for the past 15 months? What do you think?
As far as if it's an indication that a deal is done, nope. I'm a you know, Cleveland fan at this point. I have high expectations and they always get disappointed. So I always try to have low expectations when it comes to this. It's certainly a step in the right direction. And according to one source I talked to, the idea was to get together Monday in New York City and to do a quote unquote whiteboard. And the idea being that let's sit down and do the things that you and I have talked about in this podcast now for months. Let's sit down and see what the world of golf could possibly look like if there is some sort of deal. Let's see if the game's not fractured, what kind of schedule we could come up with, and getting the top players together more often and doing the things that both sides seem to have a motivation to want to do. Both sides seem to want to take the game to the next level, whatever that is, but we can't do that with this divide down the middle. So this was an opportunity to sit down and sort of, in a perfect scenario, what would that schedule look like? How would the fields be set? I love that idea. I have seen this too many times, though. I know how this is going to work out. I've been told by multiple sources what happens is they have two or three days of good talks. They feel like they're making progress. And then everybody takes a break, shakes hands and goes home. And next thing you know, the lawyers have gotten involved. And it seems like you take two steps back and you have to get back in a room again for two or three days and try to make some sort of progress. This is going to be a complicated deal. We've talked about this endlessly. And the lawyers are probably going to have the final say, but because the DOJ, the Department of Justice, is probably going to have the final say on this. So everything has to be perfect. I don't know how optimistic I am that this means a deal is getting done, but at least for some reason, they decided to get into a room and do this whiteboard exercise. And I feel like that's a step in the right direction.
It's certainly a step in the right direction. I think that if you're a golf fan, is promising. That's encouraging. That's exactly what you want to hear. You want to hear what the vision for pro golf is going to be after we've suffered through three pretty miserable years where it seems like all the conversation is about money. My question to that, Rex, if they're just now getting to the vision part and the whiteboard part, what have they been doing for the past 15 months? Why were they not initially working on this? Keep in mind, the deadline for the framework agreement to become a definitive agreement was December 31st. And then there was sort of this thinking that it was going to be done by the spring. And then you flew up the Travelers Championship thinking this was being done in the summer. And they're just now getting to the whiteboard exercises. Shouldn't have they been discussing the vision for what pro golf was going to look like for the past 15 months?
I think so, because everyone else has. Certainly you and I have wasted a lot of people's time on this podcast talking about, well, if I gave you a blank piece of paper and think about what a cool schedule you can come up with, just not PGA Tour events, but do a global schedule, do 20, 15 events, whatever it is you want to do. And how are the fields sort of comprised, and what do we want to see out of the actual competition? I think we've watched for the last 2 years now, and both of us agree like 70, 75 players doesn't quite seem right. Let's find a number that seems right. Let's find a number that gives young and up-and-coming players an opportunity to at least play their way on if they do it the right way. I don't know. My guess is up until this point, it's a lot of dotting of I's and crossing of T's. I think when both sides sat down on June, whatever it was last year, and decided to start having these conversations, at some point, those negotiations got set back because it seems like both sides felt like they had the upper hand. And that to me is never kind of the right way of doing this. I'll go back to all the things I heard about the NBA new TV rights deal, that the second you had exactly one more suitor, then you had spots to fill. And in this particular case, it was probably going to be TNT if everything played out the way it is, that you had the upper hand in the negotiations and things were going to start going quickly at that point. Because once you have the upper hand, then you can kind of dictate the terms. That's just the way business works. In this particular case, I think we've gone through stages and we can sort of map them out. That at the end of last year, clearly the PIF, LIV Golf, felt like they had the upper hand when they signed Jon Rahm to whatever that monstrous contract was and took one of the game stars away from the PGA Tour. It has since come around. I think the SSG signing and the PGA Tour announcing the creation of PGA Tour Enterprises and $1.5 billion of cash influx into the business. I think that made the tour feel like they had the upper hand. We've kind of gone through these ebbs and flows where you've never had the opportunity to take it to whatever that logical final step is, which is the whiteboard, sitting down. Let's come up with something cool. Let's come up with the best possible product for the fans, for the players, for the competition. I think that's why it took us so long to get there. I don't think the timing is coincidental here, that this was exactly less than a week after it was sort of leaked, or however it is, the report went about that Rory McIlroy and Scottie Scheffler will play Bryce DeChambeau and Brooks Koepka in one of those televised matches later this year in Las Vegas.
You think this is not coincidental?
I don't think it's coincidental.
That probably take months to get on the books. All of a sudden, they're getting their heads together again.
I don't think it's coincidental that they've gotten to this stage in the talks. I think the actual, I was asked this yesterday on Golf Today, and there's really no way to sort of say it. The idea that the Public Investment Fund and the PGA Tour were sitting down on today, Tuesday, 9/11 in New York City to have these conversations is beyond embarrassing. And look, there's plenty of outrage about this. And you just check social media. I'm not the one that needs to scream about this. We can both agree, like, just terrible timing. I don't pretend to understand how difficult it is, how complicated it is to get executives at this level in the same room at one point in time. Like, Jay Monahan's schedule, I'm sure, is really busy. Yasir Al-Rumayyan, the governor of the Public Investment Fund, probably a really busy guy. John Henry, Joe Gorder, all these people who are associated with these negotiations. Yeah, I'm sure it's hard to get them all on their private planes and get them to land in one spot and have extended conversations over a day or two. But picking this day, 9/11, awful time.
Yeah, that's something that needs to be triggering for everyone as it relates to the PGA Tour. But apparently this was when they could do it. I think big picture, as we zoom out, like, my first reaction is it's about time that this is happening. I mean, Rory McIlroy said that he had not been on a call as part of the transaction subcommittee since June. Everyone is clearly fatigued. Everyone is clearly frustrated that it is dragged on for this long. I understand, to your point about sort of the ebbs and flows of leverage, I understand the tour now has reasons, as we sit here, September 2024, to draw it out for leverage reasons and some of the contracts that could be expiring with LIV golfers, and they're essentially going to have to double down on their investment. But we're also continuing on this path where the PGA Tour's product is not as good as it could be, and the LIV Golf product is not as good as it could be. The PGA Tour is going with its plan. It's going to look basically identical in 2025 with the signature event model. LIV is building out franchises. They had a big announcement on Tuesday with some of the general managers that have now attached themselves to five of the teams. So I think it's probably a little bit dispiriting as well, Rex, that this isn't going to get solved until 2026, 2027, if ever. And hopefully it lends credence to the idea that maybe you could piecemeal this definitive agreement, push through the financial component, get the DOJ involved to rubber stamp that, as again, they continue with these whiteboard sessions.
I don't think that's the way it works. No, you'd have to probably present the finished product to the DOJ. I don't think they're less concerned with the financial terms of this than they are exactly how it's going to impact competition. That's what they would be looking at. Some sort of antitrust violation. So they'd have to see some version of the final product. And I've been told once that's ready to present to the DOJ, that's a 12 to 16 month process after that before the DOJ decides, okay, this gets a green check mark, or no, we don't like this part.
4 to 8 sponsor exemptions into the signature events. It should not be that complicated. Yet, obviously, it is that complicated. Obviously, for more on that developing story, NBCSports.com/golf. Rex has a story up on the website right now. All right. How about superlatives for the 2024 PGA Tour regular season? This guy Scheffler is still dusting off the FedEx Cup title at his home in Dallas. We will not see him again until the President's Cup. And then I would assume, Rex, the only time we would see Scottie Scheffler the rest of the year would be to defend his title at the Hero World Challenge in early December. I don't think it's any surprise that if we go to best player of 2024, the answer is going to be Scottie Scheffler. What do you think, though, is the main reason for his rise? He has been the best player on the PGA Tour for the past 3 years. Why this year was he able to elevate himself in new ways?
I think it's all the incremental gains, but if you had to point to one thing, it's going to be the putting. I mean, it was about this time last year when he decided to start working with Phil Kenyon, the putting guru from the PGA Tour. And if we're being honest, look at what happened at the Ryder Cup. he didn't look like things were going to click immediately when it comes to those putting tips. Whatever the magic secret dust that Phil sprinkles on all of his players, it hadn't really kicked in yet. But as we've seen over the course of the season, and look, and again, you're talking about percentages, incremental gains. But when you're a player of that caliber that hits the ball that well, when you can come away from almost every single tournament and you're shocked if he's not first in strokes gained tee to green, all you need is that percentages. All you need are those incremental gains on the greens. And we've seen it. It's not as though you see it week in and week out. I don't think he's ever going to be that player who just shows up and it blows away the field, both strokes gained tee to green and on the greens. However, when he can just stay average, and we saw this at the Tour Championship just a few weeks ago, if he can just keep his strokes gained somewhere around even and not give away a whole bunch of strokes on the greens, that more times than not, he's going to win. And I think that was the difference for him this year.
It certainly was the difference, at least statistically. And look, he's still an average putter statistically on the PGA Tour, ranked 69th on the PGA Tour strokes gained putting, barely breaking even in terms of that statistic and giving strokes back or gaining strokes on the field. I've told the story a couple of times. I still go back to what happened at Bay Hill and the Arnold Palmer Invitational. I had a story ready to go in advance of the Players' Championship about how the putting and the frustration and the patience that he has tried to exhibit. I talked with Scotty for about 30 minutes in the clubhouse, in the locker room at Riviera, about how he was sort of girding himself for the criticism that he was receiving on a weekly basis about his putting. And I'll go back to a moment in the third round on the 11th green. And this is going to seem very random, but Scotty missed about a 15-foot par putt, and he started berating himself. And he was very animated and frustrated, and that seemed like the breaking point for whatever reason. Now, keep in mind, Scotty put the TaylorMade Spider putter in the bag for the first time that week. Everyone sort of drew the parallel to Rory McIlroy suggesting on the broadcast of the Genesis Invitational that Scotty should put a Melt putter in the bag. Scotty said, "I've been testing it for weeks, if not months, and this was the first time that I was actually putting it in competition." He said he just needed to stick with his process, continue working at it, and he knew the gains would come. That, to me, was the breaking point. That 11th green, after that point, Rex shot 3 under the rest of the way, did not make a bogey, and then he shot a bogey-free 66 in the final round, won the golf tournament, putted well overall that week, and he was off and running for a season that was the best since Tiger Woods in 2007. 7 wins, 8 if you're including the Olympic gold medal, competitive in most of the other major championships as well. To me, the exact comp is Tiger's 2007. That was 7 wins. That was a major. That was a FedEx Cup title. That was competitive in the other major championships as well. To even be able to put yourself in the same category as a Tiger season when Tiger statistically was at his best, incredibly impressive. Look forward to seeing what Scotty is going to be able to do in 2025. How about breakout player of 2024, Rex? Who is your breakout star?
I do think it's fun that you and I went round and round about this when he actually won the American Express, but it's going to be Nick Dunlap, because he wins the American Express. As an amateur, you and I had a spirited debate, and I understood where you were coming from. You were leaning into the idea that maybe he stays in Tuscaloosa. Maybe he stays at the University of Alabama. The team was pretty good. They had a chance to win the NCAA championship. I pushed back on that idea just because of where we are at this point in time when it comes to the PGA Tour, what he had accomplished and what he had ahead of him. Very rarely are you going to get those opportunities, I think, going forward, where not only do you just land on tour with a tour card straight out of college, but you're also into the signature events and everything that means, and most of the major championships. So I thought it was an opportunity he should not pass by. He struggled. Like, look, you and I both watched over the course of from the American Express until he got later in the summer. It looked like that wasn't the same guy that won. That wasn't the same player that we thought was going to be not so much dominant, but the breakout star of this season. It wasn't until he was able to win again, do what he did in the playoffs, sort of get some sort of momentum going into the fall, that I felt like that, yes, he belongs. And look, that's kind of a ridiculous comment to make about a 20-something year old who just is fresh out of college. But the way the season went for him to win, to have all that, everything thrust upon him after the American Express victory, and to clearly go through some struggles and find a way to come out of it, that's impressive on so many levels to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Wins the Barracuda, makes it all the way to the BMW Championship, despite not getting FedEx Cup points for that American Express win. I thought Jim Furyk could have, if not should have, put him on the U.S. President's Cup team. That did not come to be. I think that was an inspired choice, Rex. I would also give an honorable mention to Luke Clanton as a breakout star, a great college season at Auburn. All he did when he come out in the came out in the PGA Tour, tied for second at the John Deere Classic, finished fifth at the Wyndham Championship. Looks like he will be a PGA Tour player sooner rather than later, thanks to the PGA Tour University Accelerator Program, which awards points for various benchmarks that are achieved. He is playing this week in Napa again, so you get another chance to see Luke Clanton statistically. I mean, this kid, if he had played enough rounds on the PGA Tour, he'd be like top five statistically. Just an incredible ball striker who is only going to get more comfortable and more confident on golf courses that he sees a second and third time. But to me, this was the easy one, Rex. The breakout star of 2024 was Xander Schauffele. This is a player we've been dogging for years about unfilled potential and how he can't get across the finish line. And yes, he was a seven-time winner on the PGA Tour. And yes, he'd finished in the top three in all the major championships. And yet he could not sort of establish himself as a preeminent player on the PGA Tour. I think Xander Schauffele's season, in which he won two major championships and somehow thrust himself in the conversation for player of the year during what was a dominant run by Scottie Scheffler, I think is a reminder that not all of these young studs are finished products by the age of 30. You can still learn, you can still evolve, you can still grow, you can still sort of find your peak, whereas I think a player's peak has been skewing younger and younger. You think about a Jordan Spieth, a Justin Thomas, a Jason Day, guys who really hit their strides in their early to mid-20s. Xander Schauffele, now at age 30, he's such a complete player, no weaknesses. He's in the best fitness and health of his career, the longest he's ever been, the most speed he has ever attained. Very impressed by what Xander Schauffele was able to do in taking his career to the next level about 6 or 7 years deep into his pro career, as opposed to a guy who's doing it fresh out of college.
But you're saying that he wasn't a star beforehand. I would counter and say, yes, he had a breakout season, but he was not already a star.
He was not a star on the
PGA Tour. Oh, I would disagree. Stars. I would say he was a star on the PGA Tour.
No one knew who
Xander Schauffele was
mainstream wise.
Oh,
he had 1 and 2 years on the PGA Tour. He was the nearly man. He was the best active player yet to win a major.
Gold medal winner, all the things you can go to, but you don't think he was a star then?
Breakout star. A breakout star for Xander Schauffele going into rarefied air in the year of 2024. All right, Rex, how about most improved player in the year of our Lord 2024?
Aaron Rye. And look, I go back to, this must have been 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, at the RSM Classic. And it's kind of the last event of the year. So you're looking for some things to sort of bridge the gap between November and when we get to Hawaii to start the season. And so I sat down with him and had kind of a long conversation. And I love the way he does the job to begin with. He does it a little bit differently. He wears the two gloves and his golf bag's a little bit different, but just the way he works is pretty impressive, because even among that set who decide that I'm going to outwork, everyone seems to think they can outwork the next guy. And I understand that's the recipe for success. Aaron Rye even stands out among that group. And you look at what he did coming down the stretch late in the season. I mean, coming down, we were already in July and he was still outside the top 70. So he's trying to scramble, trying to make sure they can get into the signature events, and just went on a tear, tied for second at the Rocket Mortgage, top 10s at the John Deere and the Scottish Open. And then of course the victory at the Wyndham Championship to get to the Tour Championship. I think that's a breakout. I think that would be a breakout star.
Breakout star, Aaron Rye. Sure. I think we're getting a little liberal.
No, most improved was the category. Okay. No, most improved is the category. So just to be clear.
That's a good pick as well. Big Aaron Rye fan, an absolute gentleman, and a scholar. Honorable mentions in this category for me, Rex, were Adam Scott, who's back inside the top 20 in the world ranking. Nearly won a couple of golf tournaments, the BMW Championship, the Genesis Scottish Open as well. Very impressive to see what he continues to do at age 44, and will now be in all the signature events next year on the PGA Tour. But my pick for this one was Colin Morikawa. Remember, Rex, when you were dogging him? I think was it the end of 2022 into 2023 where you said this is a player who's going to fall outside the top 25 in the world ranking? You were very close. You were so close.
No, I think he did at some point.
He dropped to 23rd last summer when he was sort of in the doldrums. He was going through some swing changes. He ditched his longtime coach, Rick Sessinghaus. He got together with Mark Blackburn, swing coach to Max Homa, among others. He won the Zozo Championship, but that sort of proved a little bit fleeting. He has always had a glaring weakness in his game. It has been his putting and his short game. You look at the major championships he won. Those were essentially anomalies putting-wise. Both those 2 weeks, Colin Morikawa was the top putter in the field that week. When you pair that with sublime ball striking, he is going to beat a major championship field. He is all the way, Rex, up to fourth in the world ranking once again, despite not winning a tournament in 2024. Incredibly hard to do. And I think of most importance, he has made huge strides on and around the green. Steven Sweeney, his putting coach, Rex Essinghausen, he is back with him. He's made huge short game strides. Colin Morikawa is a more complete player now in 2024 than he was in sort of his heyday in 2020 and 2021. I think that is very encouraging. The signs pointing back up to Colin Morikawa being a consistent force in the major championships as he was in the first couple years of his career. He is a complete player at this point. Best tournament, Rex. What was the best tournament in 2024?
We probably should have thought these categories through a little bit more. The best tournament for me was the U.S. Open. It was a combination of, you and I both are big fans of Pinehurst number two. It's such a unique golf course. It's such a cool place to go cover a tournament. Look, I think after Augusta, it's probably the second best venue in the United States for a major championship. But then the way everything sort of played out over the course of the week, I think Scottie Scheffler's story that week was fascinating, where he came in clearly a little burnout, a little tired after what happened at the PGA Championship. He wasn't prepared. He said as much, his words, not mine, to play that particularly unique test. And then what happened on Sunday, when it felt like at one point late on Sunday afternoon, Rory McIlroy had that event won. All he needed to do was finish up decent, not great. Like, you're talking about three or four pars coming down the stretch, and that would have won it for him. And we saw the type of meltdown that sort of defines careers, for better or worse. Sometimes I think that's what we saw out of Rory McIlroy. And then we saw sort of this new version of Bryson DeChambeau, where he seems to be a happier, more enjoyable version of himself, where he's more comfortable in his own skin. Takes a literal victory lap around Pinehurst and all everything else that goes in with that. I thought it was a fascinating tournament, and it's always the canvas that adds to it. In this particular case, the canvas was perfect.
I agree with you there. I thought the Players' Championship this year was amazing. Scottie Scheffler, sort of the neck drama. Xander Schauffele, Wyndham Clark, Brian Harman, all had chances to win that golf tournament. Instead, it ends up being Scotty erased a five-shot deficit in that final round to defend his title at TPC Sawgrass. I thought the PGA Championship this year, Rex, was amazing. Victor Hovland coming out of nowhere to contend once again. Bryson DeChambeau sort of reemerging on the world stage, and then Xander Schauffele pulling it out by lipping in that six-foot birdie putt on the 72nd hole. I thought was a great tournament. But yeah, the tournament of the year, the tournament we're going to remember most this year, was the U.S. Open. It wasn't just the late falter by Rory McIlroy. It wasn't just the 72nd hole wedge shot out of the bunker by Bryson DeChambeau. That final 60 to 90 minutes was as good as it can get in golf because of the two protagonists that you had in Rory and Bryson. I thought it was also an ideal setting at Pinehurst, sort of the American Mecca and home of golf. And the setting at Pinehurst was amazing because after they cleared out all the trees, like, you could see action on multiple holes. And I thought that that was really important to what eventually played out. And Rory McIlroy admitted that he found himself a little distracted or thinking a little bit too much about what some of the other players in contention, particularly Bryson, were doing over that final hour. I thought the setting only enhanced the drama and how compelling that tournament was. For me, that was the enduring tournament of 2024, the one we're probably going to remember for a very, very long time. How about the biggest moment? Biggest moment of 2024 was what?
One. So just to clarify here, these are two separate categories, biggest moments and most memorable scenes. I just want to make sure, like, people are going to hear me, like, what are you talking about? Because I think the biggest moment from a golf perspective was actually on Sunday in Paris at the Olympics, when Scottie Scheffler had to do Scottie Scheffler things to win the gold medal. And look, we've been through now, this was the third iteration of what these games are going to look like when it applies to golf. And we've gone from Rio, where the top players seem to kind of dismiss the idea that it's an Olympic sport. They didn't really want to cut into their schedule that time of year. They didn't want to travel all the way down there. Zika virus scared a lot of guys. So that impacted there. Clearly, COVID impacted the Tokyo Olympics a few years later. But this was sort of the culmination of what golf was trying to do by moving into the Olympics. Why executives from the PGA Tour thought it was important for golf to be an Olympic sport. And you saw it with the emotion on Scotty Scheffler's face when he's standing on the podium getting the gold medal. They, you know, I think the star players have talked about it enough now that it resonates and it means something that 20 years from now, you win major championships and that's going to define your career. But winning a gold medal or any medal at all is also going to be part of that legacy, a big part of that legacy. And I think you saw the emotion. I don't think we get a chance to see sort of the raw emotion out of Scotty Scheffler like we did on that Sunday. And just the drama that went into sort of that final round, John Rahm collapsing. You had Victor Perez sort of igniting the home crowd, trying to make a run to the podium. All of those things factor into, I thought it was such a cool scene.
Great final couple hours at that Paris Olympics. Rahm, Xander had a chance to win the gold medal as well. Remember Rory rinsing one on 15 when he had an outside shot to win it, and then Scotty Scheffler doing what he did, shooting 62 in the final round. I think the capstone to what was a sensational 2024 for Scotty Scheffler. I'm going biggest moment. This is probably going to sound a little bit more negative than yours, but my biggest moment was Roy McIlroy's 2.5-foot miss on the 16th green at the aforementioned U.S. Open. That miss in particular, and remember, he put his hand to he missed it left. He stop it. Please don't go too far away. I don't want to be in this position where I'm going to potentially miss this one as well. I think that miss was so crushing and so damning and sort of the indictment of Roy McIlroy and where he is in 2024. That miss completely changes how we view Roy McIlroy's season. And I think, Rex, it could even change how we view his career to this point, which has only been defined by misses over the past decade, a player who looked like he was going to take the world by storm and I guess still could at the age of 35, but potentially be challenging Tiger Woods' record for major championships. Instead, that has stalled out and something broke inside Rory over that final hour, the three bogeys over his final four holes, the missed club on 15, the short miss on 16, the missed approach on 17. Remember, he had to get up and down out of the bunker on 17, the par three, just to salvage par and give himself a shot. And then what happened on 18, which I sort of give that one a pass. Like that was a much harder putt than the one that he had on 16. It was about a 4.5-footer playing it well outside the left downhill where if he doesn't hit the hole, that thing is going so far past. But the short miss completely broke him. And I think it's why you see Rory now majorless for the past decade. That one completely changed his 2024 outlook. All right, most memorable scene. I'm assuming we are going to agree on this one.
We are. Again, we didn't really talk these out this morning before we sat down because I think we're going to have some overlap on this one. And I do want to take an opportunity, not make light of this at all, but I just want to point out the distinction between what happened to Scotty Scheffler on that Friday morning in front of Valhalla with the Louisville police detective getting arrested, that we have since sort of sussed through all the body cam footage, everything that needed to be sussed through. And it seems like in that particular moment, Scotty Scheffler was trying to do what was right and things escalated. I'll go to what happened on Sunday in front of the Miami Dolphins Stadium with Tyreek Hill and a very, very similar situation. You have a professional athlete that's just trying to get to work and we still don't know the exact details. But I do want to point out very, very quickly that even in this situation, the NFL is going to one-up golf like it does on every other category, because Scotty Scheffler ended up going to jail. Now, he got out in time to make his tee time. He got out in time to actually shoot a 66, to play well. All of those things are part of the legend right now. Hill never went to jail. He was put on the ground. He was handcuffed. There's so many things wrong with that situation. And again, I'm not making light of it. The difference, though, is that you had the head of NFL security, or I'm sorry, the head of Miami Dolphins security, and another executive, and his grandparents, and his agent. They were all right there to de-escalate the situation. Scotty Scheffler never had that person. He had Jeff Darlington, who tried, but was on the wrong side of that one and wisely stepped back when the officer told him to step back. But you see the difference in the situation. For golf, though, it is still going to be the moment that I think stands out throughout the entire season. And I don't want to take anything away from what Scotty accomplished this season. It was historic. You and I have compared this to only Tiger Woods 07, whatever year you want to pick, is the comp here. But it's going to be that Friday morning in the rain and the dark and the confusion and the escalation that I think is going to define this golf season.
How was Tyreek Hill not cited for having illegal tint?
I didn't realize that was in the conversation.
He was cited for two, that the biggest issue was that his
he rolled out the window. Yeah.
and it was too dark that the officer could not see. Of course, it is not illegal to keep your window up, but the officer has to see you. I digress.
I have a better question. How is Jeff Darlington always there when an athlete gets arrested? Always.
Always. Man just on the spot.
Nothing but raging jealousy inside this reporter that somehow I can't land in the right spot.
I mean, and he has done a phenomenal job. First, yes, Scottie Scheffler story, and then with the reporting on Tyreek Hill. I'm with you. The most surreal scene was Scottie Scheffler getting arrested and then playing the second round of the PGA Championship. You and I split our duties that day. You went to the jail to see what the deal was with Scottie Scheffler or the courthouse. I went to the golf course, and it was a surreal scene on the bus because there was still some skepticism among media members that Scottie Scheffler had actually gotten arrested. And I was trying to feed them updates in real time. Like, we're pulling the police records, we're pulling the incident report, we're pulling his mugshot. And everyone thought the mugshot was Photoshop, because how could Scottie Scheffler, world number one golfer, recognizable golfer, all around great human being, have gotten arrested on the eve of the second round of the PGA Championship? There was still disbelief that this was actually happening. I will maintain, Rex, in the sort of the zoo and the scene that transpired when he got to the golf course. Again, you mentioned he shot 66. I will maintain that arrest did more for Scottie's popularity than winning ever could. And I say that because the grace and the poise that he showed in what was a clearly a traumatic event, but the way that he handled the second round, the way that he handled the post round press conference, the sort of the perspective that he showed, saying his heart went out to the gentleman who died earlier that morning. He gave credit to the Louisville Police Department, even though perhaps they did not deserve credit for their actions that morning. The thoughtfulness in some of his answers. I thought the popularity spike that he got from being so mainstream in that moment, plus the way that he handled that, I thought made him into a global star, as opposed to just being strictly a golfer in a very strange way. And I'm sure Scottie Scheffler wishes he had never gone through it. I think popularity wise, among sports fans, that did more than winning seven times in a PGA Tour season ever could.
We have a really popular Halloween party in my neighborhood. The Hollands hold it, and it's like, it's a production, and the same couple wins it every year, and they need to have their own category. We were talking about this just last weekend, but I was talking with my wife about, okay, now we need to figure out, we always try to come up with some sort of
are costumes. You going to be Detective Brian Gillis?
Well, that's what I suggested. I said, to your point, she goes, no, that would be so cliched. And I go, you think that a lot of people are going to show up as Scottie Scheffler and Detective Brian Gillis? That's what you think? And she said, yes. Because I said, you can be Scotty. Like, it's fine. We'll give you a little beard and a Nike hat. But she wanted no part of it. To your point. And when you
make sure you rip those $75 pants.
Sure. I'll do that as well. And I suggested all of this, and she wanted nothing to do with it. So I don't think it's actually going to go through. To your point, and I think you said this that day in the confusion and everything that was happening, and I probably rolled my eyes at it because I'm thinking, no, if you win the Masters, that's different. It is different still for golf fans. But to your point, yes. I think that mugshot and everything that went into, you're right. It's one thing to get arrested. It's one thing to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's another thing to do it with grace. And it's another thing to do it with class. And that's what Scottie did. And you're right. I think that gained him fans off the golf course all the way across the spectrum. I would love to see the numbers because he's not on social media. And I have no idea. I assume they're just going to hand him the pip check, which they still do just for the top 10 this year. But I would love to see the actual number breakdown of how that spiked his popularity way beyond golf. And there is something to be said for, yeah, he handled that the right way. Very, very awful situation that could have been much worse. And the way he handled it made it something that I feel comfortable now dressing up as Scottie Scheffler or Detective Brian Gillis for Halloween.
You know, golf has made it when the sort of the first comp when Tyreek Hill gets arrested is, wow, Scottie Scheffler. Really similar to the Scottie Scheffler situation. All right, Rex, how about top disappointments for 2024? It does not just have to be one. If there are a number of grievances you'd like to air,
I do.
People you'd like to dump on, please, the floor is yours.
I do. The first one, I actually do have a couple outside the lines looking in. I was going to start with Jordan Spieth. However, there is a degree of sympathy that you have to have for Jordan, knowing now the wrist injury, knowing now that surgery was imminent, knowing now that he was just trying to grind through it for the reasons that we touched on earlier in the podcast about how important it is to be inside that magical top 50 number and be inside, be into the signature event. So I'm going to move him down the list and probably lean into more like a Ricky Fowler, who I spoke to a lot this season. And every time you talk to him, like most players in this situation, kept saying he was close, he was close, he was close. He's 118th, I believe, right now on the FedEx Cup points list. He's going to have to play really well in the fall just to keep his tour card. And that probably means nothing to Ricky Fowler at this point in his career. He has plenty of avenues. He'll get plenty of sponsor exemptions. But to me, it is glaring for a player of that caliber to struggle that much, given the opportunities that he was given. He was in a lot of those signature events. So he had all those opportunities. However, the person on the list that's going to win the award for me is going to be Jay Monahan, for the reasons that Rory voiced just a few weeks ago at Eastlake. Look, if you're a golf fan, you should be aggravated that we're at this point still, however many months down the road from the June 6th framework agreement announcement. And maybe all of the blame should not go on his shoulders. Maybe the governor of the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia deserves just as much blame when it comes to this. But the idea when they announced the framework agreement was to reunite the game and to do away with all the distractions. And to a certain degree, that happened, because I'm not covering lawsuits anymore, so I do appreciate that. However, we're still talking about how it's odd that you and I both agreed that the U.S. Open was the best event of the year. And there's no coincidence that that just happened to be Rory and Bryson going head-to-head, because you still have many of the game's top players on that side. And I think everything else in between has become irrelevant after the majors, and I'm talking about both products, because you can't make a legitimate argument that if you win a signature event that I beat the best field. And I think that's bothersome, and it's time for Goff and Jay Monahan and the PIF side to come around and put an end to this one way or the other.
Yep, I had Jay Monahan on the list. His press conference.
We should have gone over these before we actually. Yeah, we probably should have touched base.
But his press conference at Eastlake for the Tour Championship was a big nothing burger. Frustrating for people who want to hear a short and long term vision for the PGA Tour. I do wonder, to bring up your point of the signature events and not beating all the best in the world, I do wonder in like 5, 10, 15 years, like how will people view Scottie's year? Will they view it in the same breath as Tiger Woods' 2007? Here we won 7 times, won a major, won a FedEx Cup. Or will people sort of pick nits, to use my favorite expressions, and say, look, he didn't beat the best players in the world. That was during a time when the PGA Tour was fractured. That was a time when there was divided talent among the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. He wasn't beating John Rahm, Brooks Koepka, Cam Smith, Bryce DeChambeau, Dustin Johnson, and the like. He was just being the best on the PGA Tour. I do wonder sort of down the road how we'll view it. I think right now it's unfair, but in time, it would not surprise me if this is sort of the lost era of the PGA Tour when there was so much divided talent. Other players I had on this biggest disappointment list, Victor Hovland went from playing the best golf in the world about 12, 13 months ago. I think he was the best, one of the best players on that European Ryder Cup team, along with Roy McIlroy that week, completely lost his game, seemed like he was spiraling. At times, almost withdrew prior to the PGA Championship because he did not think that he had a chance to win. Goes out and has his best performance of the year at Valhalla. John Rahm was a disappointment to me. I know he finished in the top 10 at the Open Championship. I know his strokes gain numbers are pretty good. I know he has finished inside the top 10 in every live event he has played. But again, when you're going to have so few opportunities for all of the best players to play together, again, very disappointing performance in his title defense at the Masters. Very disappointing missed cut. The PGA Championship didn't even suit up at the U.S. Open and at a venue at Pinehurst that would have suited him quite well because of the foot issue. And then, yes, he finished in the top 10 at the Open Championship, but never had a serious chance to win that golf tournament. The Olympics as well, which probably could have salvaged a 2024. Yes, blowing a 5-shot lead at the back nine at the Golf National. Not ideal as well. And of course, I put Jordan Spieth on there and his injury. Here's hoping that Jordan can bounce back in a big way in 2025. All right, we are 41 minutes deep into this podcast, Rekt, but there is at least some golf to pay attention to this week. I think it's pretty rare, is it not, that the PGA Tour actually has the worst event on the schedule at this point in the season? It's kind of amazing. Like, all my attention this week is going to be on the Solheim Cup. I loved covering it last year in Spain. Semi-disappointed I will not be here to cover it at RTJ. Our boss, Mercer Bags, is on the ground to cover the biennial duel between the United States and Europe. Roy McIlroy is in the field, the Irish Open at Royal County Down. I believe it's now rated the number one golf course in the world, as ranked by Golf Digest. Have not had an opportunity to play that golf course. Looking forward to seeing that. And then, of course, you have the Pro Court Championship, formerly known as the Fortinet, formerly known as, I don't know, fries.com. It's gone through a number of iterations. But yes, Silverado is always a good watch as well. What's on your radar this week? I can hear you pounding loudly as you look for Royal County Downs. A status among the best courses in the world.
I was shocked when you said it. And I love Royal County Down as much as the next person. I've been fortunate enough to play there, but I don't know that I would make it number one on my list. It's going to be inside the top 10 on my list, but I'm a little, hold on. I just need to make sure. Yep. You got it right. That one shocks me a little bit. Would not be number one on my list. Probably that one though, because you want to see all of the top players playing a golf course like that, somewhere that's special, somewhere that's unique, somewhere that's got character. Played it right off the plane. There's a lot of blind tee shots on that golf course. Yeah, that was difficult. Going to watch Napa to a certain degree, and you took the swing. Although I had it in my notes ready to take the swing yesterday on Golf Today. Certainly, it's Max Homa that both of us are going to look at and throw more shade on, because that's what everyone seems to want to do. And look, this is not personal. I think I kind of got aggregated a little bit with some things I said last week. And this is not personal. I like Max as a person. I like Max as a player. I'm just looking at this. If you were to break down statistically, which Jim Furyk, the captain of the year's team, clearly didn't do, if you were to do an analytic breakdown of the type of player you want on that team for that golf course, and again, I've made the comp. This is very, very similar to what they faced at Le Golf National for that Ryder Cup that Jim Furyk was also the captain of that team. You need a straight driver. You need someone that's going to put you in the fairway, especially in team play. And the one thing that Max has not done well this season is drive the ball well. I think you pointed out yesterday on Golf Today, he's 100 spots worse compared to the rest of the field in strokes gained off the tee. That's not the guy you want to have as a partner. I know he's a team guy. I know he's good in the locker room. But I've become very, very weary of captains who dismiss the analytics side of it. And I'm not saying it should be all about analytics. I know there's a balance between personality and guts and what a captain feels. But there has to be some element of this that you can look statistically and say, yeah, he's not a good fit. And the idea that Max Homa is going to finish up early, not advance very far in the playoffs, and then somehow find something magical at home and put it in play this week in Napa and be good to go going into Royal Montreal. That to me is, I think we've done this before, and that's the definition of insanity.
I mean, you never see an elite player who is ranked 154th in strokes gained off the tee. I mean, driving has become so important for these players to then attack with short irons, in which, you know, some of them can be a little spotty in that respect, but all of them are good drivers of the golf ball. And to see such a glaring weakness from such an elite player is certainly a little bit shocking. He's neither long nor particularly accurate, which is just a terrible combination. Silverado is a golf course that really places a premium on putting the ball in the fairway. He's a two-time winner there. Royal Montreal, as you mentioned, is going to be placing a premium on putting the ball in the fairway. The reasons that Jim Furyk put him on the team were because of past performance in these cups, both the 2022 President's Cup and the 2023 Ryder Cup, as well as his passion for team play and being a good teammate. Nowhere did he mention his recent results, recent performance. Max Homa needs a good week. I also would throw Mackenzie Hughes in that category. Did not advance to the BMW Championship. Was put on this team because of his good short game and his great putter. I think that's going to be very interesting as well. I think Mackenzie Hughes is going to have a lot of pressure on him as a captain's pick, playing in his first President's Cup, playing at home, and playing Rex after being picked over Nick Taylor, who won a golf tournament this year, and over Adam Hadwin, who again had statistically a better season than Mackenzie Hughes did. Mackenzie Hughes and Max Homa, two of six President's Cuppers who are in the field this week in Napa. The Solheim Cup, Rex, who you got and why?
Europe, and only because, and this was a crash course because we were told we were going to be asked Solheim Cup questions yesterday on Golf Today. Nothing more specific than that, just Solheim Cup questions, which immediately puts both of us on a very nervous, edgy sort of footing, because it's not as though we can just come up with interesting things to say off the top of our head. The last time the United States won this, it was 2017. And that is a lifetime ago. And look, we had this conversation about the President's Cup, and I'm sure it'll come up again over the next few weeks. But without parity, you're not going to have a very popular event. If one side is dominating this week in and week out, and the Solheim Cup, to be fair, is not there. It is still a very close competition. You had a tie recently. However, if you continue to trend in that direction, where the United States continues to struggle every 2 years in this situation, it does put the competition in danger. And it makes no sense, because I think you could probably break it down. It's a very, very similar scenario where the United States probably should be the favorite on paper, but it hasn't played out that way.
It has at least been close. I mean, it was a tie. Yeah. In 2023 in Spain, that was the first time that the Americans had ever raced out to a 4-0 sweep. And then it was sort of a gritty effort by the Europeans. Like the European team, sort of like the European Ryder Cup team, are always underdogs, at least on paper. There's about a 20-point average world ranking gap between the Americans this year and the European Solheim Cuppers. I did a lot of research because I was co-hosting Golf Today for 3 days, which was very Solheim Cup heavy around the captain's picks. I think if the Americans don't win this year, there's going to be some questions about why foundationally this is not happening. They have RTJ Robert Trent Jones Golf Course in Virginia that is tailor-made for this team. They've set the golf course up that should favor them with wider fairways and little rough and a pretty long venue as well. You look at sort of the form this year. The European Solheim Cup team does not have a single victory on the LPGA this year, whereas you have a Nelly Korda on the American side, or a Lilia Vu, who's back in form, even a Laura Coughlin, who is an experienced rookie on this team, who has had a good year for the Americans as well. This should be an American victory by course, by form, by stature, by home crowd favorite. And if they don't win, I think there'll be some heavy criticism of Stacey Lewis, who's so sort of to your point about Jim Furyk leaning more into that feel than analytics. Stacey Lewis is going almost exclusively by statistics and analytics, as our friend Justin Ray and sort of the backroom staff, which is a complete contrast for how Suzanne Pedersen does it, who always does it by instincts and guts, heart and passion, all of those sorts of intangibles. That's why I think it's a compelling matchup captain-wise, and I can't wait until this kicks off on Friday on Golf Channel. Again, we'll have coverage from our boss, Mercer Bags, at nbcsports.com/golf. All right. That is going to do it for this edition of Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Rex and I will be back on Sunday to recap a very eventful week. Boy, for September, the week of September 9th, it is an eventful week in golf. It should be very compelling. Again, go to the website if you want more information. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. Enjoy the rest of your week. And let's see who wins that Solheim Cup.
Congratulations, Ashley.